This is XTP Media.
Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Hi, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome back to Aviation Extended. This week I've been at Farnborough and seen the future of aviation. I've spent the whole week focused on the sector, mainly for the work I do during my day job. But this episode is all about history and the restoration project some of you are familiar with on the Fairey Barracuda DP-872 at the Fleet Air Arm Museum at Yeovilton in the UK. It wasn't planned because I met up with fellow aviation podcast host Dave Homewood from the Wings Over New Zealand podcast, a good friend and strong supporter of Extended. Dave is over in England on one of his massive Cover the UK Aviation Sector in 6 Weeks tour. He'd planned to visit the museum and I was to tag along, but I stole a little bit of Dave's time and I asked him to join me in this feature whilst we were there. So Dave does co-host this interview with me. Also, you may have heard our last episode with Johnny McNee and seen the connection. It's a complete accident that these two episodes were so close together. It was purely coincidental, but shows the networks within the aviation world. It was in fact Dave Homewood who suggested I look up Johnny McNee, and of course, Johnny was involved in the excavation of DP-872. Such a small world sometimes. Enjoy the feature. So we're in the Fleet Air Arm Museum. I've got Dave Homewood.
Hello.
I've got Will.
Hello.
And I've got Dave Morris.
Hi.
And we're here to talk about the Barracuda restoration. It's been a very, very long time since I was last here. And we were here to talk about the update, but a lot has happened. So first, Dave, let's talk about the last 6 or 7 years since I was last here. What's updated us on the Barracuda restoration?
Okay. Just thinking about that, it sounds a long time, 6 to 7 years. And I remember your visit here, as we were just discussing. That was around about the time that we were looking at going to Norway, the north of Norway, to Alta, to investigate whether the wreck of LS-551 was achievable, what was there, how feasible it might be to bring it back. And that must have been about 2018. And at the end of 2018, 2019, National Grid were laying a huge interconnector cable across the Solent, came across a Barracuda in the Solent just off Stokes Bay.
Okay.
So suddenly everything stopped for the Alta sort of recce. And we turned our attentions to the Solent wreck, which National Grid very, very kindly and generously brought out the wreckage for our use. And there's a huge amount of valuable material came out of that. That all needed to be treated, desalinated, processed thoroughly and quickly. So that took up our time for the rest of, or into 2019. But then, of course, came lockdown.
Yeah.
So we weren't expecting that. Lots of that then had to stay bubbling in desalination tanks with a much, much reduced workforce working on it, but still trying to save the parts. Came out of lockdown, and of course it took a year to 18 months to get the museum back up and fully functioning and running. And then, very fortuitously, two very interested brothers who had an uncle they had never known, because he'd lost his life on the Norwegian raids in a Barracuda, a man called Arthur Kimberley. So the Burge brothers got interested in the Barracuda project and has given it a huge push forwards, because the new area that the build, you can see there, the build in the new jig and in that new viewing area, that's been enabled by the Burge brothers. It's called the Arthur Kimberley Viewing Gallery in memory of their uncle Arthur. And the Burge brothers enabled us to start re-looking at going back to Altafjord.
Right.
So June 2024, we did a recce up the mountain, very fast, couple of days, mapping it, GPSing the parts, looking at what was there, assessing very quickly in a couple of days, just how much value there might be, and was it worth going there to get the parts? And the answer to that quite quickly was yes. There's a lot of good material that we found there, and came back then with a clear plan to put together to go and get the parts the following year. Now, we had to move quickly on that because people were beginning to be more aware of that wreck, LS551. It had been shot down on the Tirpitz raid, 1944. And unfortunately, people were beginning to go and souvenir hunt or pick it up for scrap metal or get components to put on eBay or whatever. And we were aware that the wreck was just becoming more identified. People were doing a lot more walking after lockdown. People had better walking clothes, Gore-Tex clothing, GPS. Everybody was out doing hill walking and mountain walking. So there was a lot more people now knowing where LS551 was, on top of the fact that, you know, people were aware of what we were doing and that we were looking at it. So it was becoming a bit of a target. So we had to move quickly.
Dave, just before you move quickly, yeah, what's involved in something like that? Because we skirted over two wrecks there, but there's an awful lot in terms of planning that we've heard from Johnny in our last episode on how you plan something like that, the permissions you need, and all that governance you've got to wade through before you even get to put a spade in the soil, as they say.
Absolutely, and I was literally just about to switch back to saying it isn't quite as easy as I've just made it sound. The National Grid recovery in the Solent, they were handling that because they had their clearance divers moving ahead of their cable laying process. So the Coast Guard authority, the Wrecks Commission, all of the seabed mapping authorities, the MOD, because the aircraft still belongs to the MOD. There's a lot of people involved just to take effectively what sounds like a wreck off of the seabed. So there's a lot of protocols there. There's a lot of permissions need to be granted. There's a lot of MOD approvals that need to be sought and approved. But National Grid had a big team in place already because they were mapping an entire seabed across the Solent. So that was taken care of. The wreck on Alta, the LS551 wreck, we had to do that in-house. And it's all of those things that I've just mentioned, the MOD, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, because there were two fatalities in that wreck, although they were recovered at the time and buried in Tromso Cemetery. Then there's the Joint Compassionate Centre at Innsworth in Gloucestershire that deal with, again, fatalities or serious injuries involved with crashes. They have to give their approvals. And each stage would give you the recommendations to who you need to talk to next. So then it was the Norwegian embassy and the Norwegian air attaché, the Norwegian military, the Norwegian military museum, the Norwegian export division, all seeking various letters of approval, certificates at each stage before you've even got the permission to basically go up and do the survey on the mountain, a proper full survey. And even at that point, that was not to touch or move objects. That was just a view only. So that was the 2024 recce mission. And then, of course, another round of paperwork to take it to the next level to permit you to actually move and remove objects. So there's a lot of very, very official government line, Ministry of Defence and government line paperworks and approvals you have to have in place before you can just go and collect some parts. I think people think you can just get in a van and go and get it. No, you can't. That would be illegal, and you'd be putting a very big foot wrong by doing that.
But what was so attractive about what you were seeing in Norway? What was it that was the big attraction? I mean, this wasn't just an assembly of bits and pieces. There was a lot more to it.
Indeed. The aircraft had struck the mountain. Obviously, it crashed. It had taken what we now understand to be flak damage. We had people in the local village who had family members that had relayed stories over the year of seeing it on fire and crashing into the mountain. So all this began to tally, where the damage that we were discovering on the aircraft was matching up with eyewitness accounts. And the aircraft does look like it had sort of semi-inverted and crashed into the mountainside with a lot of the underside, largely undamaged, but better condition than the upper surface parts of the aircraft. Most of the crash sites that we've recovered to date have all crashed with the aircraft typically the correct way up. So the Alterac had a lot of underside components that we didn't have on the other crash site wreckage, including some pretty significant historic items like the bomb crutch for the special 1,600-pound bomb that had been approved very last minute. Right. For the squadrons to use on the Tirpitz raid. So we believe there's a bomb crutch on LS551's underside, which we've got and will keep as an historic item, not just because it's probably the only 1,600-pound special bomb crutch that we know exists, but around it on the underside of the undercarriage, you can see where it's very, very hastily put in place, probably on the ships only days before the raid. There's cut lines, pencil lines, arrows pointing at cut here. There's chain drilled holes which have been very, very hastily filed out. It's a really, really good visual example of how something's rushed into service on a ship days before the use, and that merits keeping because of that story that it tells. So Alta yielded an enormous amount of really, really useful parts, including those, like say, historic parts as well, which now gives us a total of 7 crash sites worth of wreckage to add into our build of DP-872. Just keeps increasing the amount, the percentage of original Barracuda material that we can put into this rebuild, just keeping the Barracuda that much more factory authentic. So thanks to everybody that was involved in that operation, whether it was at the official level, whether it was at the government, MOD, embassies, overseas officialdom, right down to a very, very small group of incredibly helpful Norwegians on the ground in the Alta area. Without any of them's help, it just wouldn't have happened, And of course, the Burgess who helped to make it happen.
What was it like for the actual recovery? Was that a major mission to get that one out of the Solent and the one off the mountainside?
The Solent recovery, fortunately, like I say, the National Grid had a floating barge, a recovery barge, tracking its way across the Solent ahead of the cable laying process. So parts of shipping containers, old fridges, wrecked cars which have fallen off a ferry over the years. Who knows? Goodness knows what was down there on the seabed as junk, bits of old boat, anchors, all sorts of stuff littering the seabed. They had a dive team working ahead of them, lifting all of that up in undersea recovery baskets. So, they could get stuff floated into a basket, lifted up, lifted away. And that's largely how the Barracuda came up onto the dive barge and then got transferred to land. So we were very lucky there with a dive barge with a huge crane on board and a full recovery team, not just picking up Barracuda, but anything else which was in the way on the seabed. So they dealt with all of that and they had the complications of how to lift it into the baskets on the seabed, but they did a great job. The mountainside wreck, that was different. We had to map it, which we did in 2024. We gridded the area, photographed it, used drone photographing, GPS of all of the key and major parts that we wanted to go back and re-find amongst the bracken a year later. So we had to be mindful of that. It was right on the tree line, but there was still quite a lot of bracken growth there. So we needed to be sure we didn't miss anything. We would have one shot at this if we could get the funding to do it the following year. And then the 2025 expedition to go up and recover it, we had a company called Heli Team, which are based in the north of Norway. They were successful in getting the job to give us helicopter support. They actually helicoptered us up the first day with nets and lifting bags and put us on the mountain very quickly, saved us most of a morning's walk up to the wreck site. Excellent, brilliant helicopter pilots flew us in, and we were joined, like I say, by three or four very, very knowledgeable, very helpful Norwegians who were very familiar with that immediate terrain on that piece of mountain. And everybody worked their socks off all day long to bag and net everything that we needed. And then the following day, heli team came back in and airlifted the components out to a field at the foot of the mountain, where again the landowner was hugely supportive of the project, let us put a shipping container on his field, let us airlift all of the parts down, and the same team the next day just worked their hearts out to get it all packed into the shipping container, and the whole thing was tidied up in three very long daylight days. That's why we picked the middle of July, because it's nearly 24-hour daylight up there. But it was a great success. The weather was kind. The team was brilliant. And we picked up everything that we expected to recover, plus a few other items which we found in the bracken, which were absolute gems, thanks to having those extra few Norwegians to scour and scout through the bracken.
Just with that Solent find, what are the odds of them just being there, cutting that swathe through that piece of water and finding that extremely rare aircraft? Makes you wonder how many other aircraft are just around it, or if they'd gone 100 meters the other direction, you might never have ever found that.
Absolutely, it is a million to one shot probably. I don't know, there is a lot of wreckage on the seabed. They had to keep the interconnector cable as straight as possible for the way they needed to lay it. The fact that that came almost nose to nose with a barracuda in the mud is extraordinary. Yeah, I often think of that, and you're absolutely right. 20, 30 yards to the left or right, we would never have known it existed.
Two more questions. One is with the one on the side of the mountain, you mentioned that two were killed in it. Was it only two aboard, or did one get out? Or
no, the telegraphist air gunner, leading airman Carroll, he bailed out. He managed to bail out, and the eyewitness accounts from those villagers that we were talking about earlier saw it. They saw the aircraft on fire. They saw somebody parachute out. He was taken prisoner of war. He went to Stalag-Luft 3, spent the rest of the war in Stalag-Luft 3. And many years ago, back in, I think it was the 1990s, he survived the war and visited the museum. I've now discovered back in the 1990s, a long way back before we were expecting to go to Alta and you know, seriously relook at that wreck, and donated his diary and his medals and some of his personal effects from that time. So we do have a connect in the museum with that crash, but through the telegraphist air gunner who did make a successful escape.
Okay, that's great.
Let me come to you, Will. Yeah. Lots of bits and pieces came out of both of those sites. Tell us a little bit about how you go about preserving and sifting, for want of a better description, through those parts to see what's usable, what's salvageable, and what you can then put into DP872.
Two different scenarios. So you got the Solent wreck has obviously been in the sea for nearly 70 years, and that had been partially buried in thankfully muddy conditions, but had also been encrusted with crustacean type material, and that had preserved a lot of the metal components, and quite a lot of the aluminium structure from the Solent wreck had taken the brunt of the corrosion, thus saving the metal parts. So we managed to save, there was a few aluminium parts, a bell crank and a bit of pilot seat and another part that had actually survived, and they've gone into or going into the restoration. But in terms of the Solent wreck material, it got transported to us in seawater.
Yeah.
To keep it in as best of conditions that it came, found it. And then we ended up having to sift it all out and go through a desalination process using citric acid and a monitoring process to leach out all of the salts. And then the steel components were, you have to clean them by hand. And then they go for wet media blasting. And then another round of corrosion. It's a chemical process where you can get rid of all the rust that's in the grain or pitting or basically it goes off for plating.
Okay. I realize you were taking it that far.
Yeah. So all the steel components go off for zinc.
Zinc coating.
Yeah, it's zinc nickel plating. They would have originally been cadmium plated and zinc plated back then because they were running out of cadmium.
Yeah.
So some components were zinc plated. We're going that far with the steel components. In terms of like a high mountainside wreck, you haven't got a desalination process. So basically it's just making sure that you've gotten rid of all the corrosion and then the same process.
Okay.
And obviously that aluminium parts, they go for anodizing.
Yeah.
And so how do you archive and decide what you want to use in the restoration project?
That's a good question. That's a tricky one.
apart from everything, of course.
It has to go through the inspection process. So you have to, sometimes you can think, you know, that component is going to look good. And it's not until you start cleaning it, it's gone through the wet media process of taking off any corrosion or top coating that you need to get rid of to study the component. You can go through all that process and then find out, actually, you can't use that bit. It's got intergranular corrosion on aluminium parts. And don't forget, we're trying to build a barracuda that has to hold its own weight.
Yeah.
So we can't just go sticking in really badly corroded components, because 5 years, 10 years' time, that could give way and you know, wouldn't be good. And also corrosion spread. So it, you know, you start setting up a corrosion spread through the aircraft on not only the original parts, but the new parts that you've made to go into it.
Yeah.
Okay. So put you on the spot here a bit. I don't know whether Dave's got an answer to this. So since I was last here, you've added an awful lot to your inventory. How many bits, how many parts, how many things could you imagine you've added? Because, you know, we're looking at the airframe, it's moved on a bit and we're going to go and have a look at that. But any idea of how much you've added?
That's an interesting question, and one we are actually trying to fathom out and get into a record, an actual structured record, because obviously we do want and we need to record all of our work. We need to record the conservation work. We need to be able to demonstrate what we know that we've got. But that's going to fall into several categories of pieces that we finally can use, that are good enough to use, good enough to go to the build, parts that we will still retain as useful pattern items or second grade parts, and unfortunately, a collection of items which would just be too far gone, too corroded, too bent, too mangled to be of any use. The final headcount of what each of those categories will be, we don't know yet because we're still processing. But I mean, it's many thousands of parts. We're not talking about dozens or hundreds. It's thousands and thousands of parts that we've been able to achieve. That big count up is still going on as part of the recording process. Just while we're looking at analyzing it, because all of that requires analyzing of the parts, which starts to become interesting in itself. William may already have mentioned that we're identifying that we've got parts on whatever aircraft it is, or whatever wreckage that we're working from, parts that have come from other factories that were building Barracudas. So whether it's Bolton Paul aircraft might end up with some Blackburn parts on it, or ferry aircraft wreck might actually have Westland parts or Bolton Paul parts on. So it starts to describe how parts were being interchanged amongst the factory builds during, you know, World War II. And if we take that to another extreme, and I've got them noted down here because it's a number conundrum in itself, LS551 on the mountainside in Alta. We have yet to find a component marked on its inside, like a lot of components obviously are, panel work and skin work. We've yet to find anything which actually says LS551. we have found a panel which says LS548, which was from another Barracuda, which made us think, ooh, have we actually not got LS551?
We are convinced we have.
We are now, yes, and I can explain why in a second, but LS548 was there as a piece of wreckage with it stenciled on the inside, like a factory stencil, which made us stop in our tracks. Some research has shown that LS548 existed post the Tirpitz raids and was on another squadron. So, okay. So that's looking highly likely that LS548's panel managed to migrate onto LS551 on board the ship or in the hangar or wherever it was servicing alongside. Yeah. Then we stopped in our tracks again because we had LS451 turned up on a panel, which was clearly a Barracuda panel. But when we did the research and number crunching, that's actually a Swordfish number.
Okay.
Looks like it's stenciled on in the factory. It looks like somebody in the factory has completely misidentified a particular panel with a fairy range Swordfish number, not a Barracuda number. So at this stage, we were really beginning to scratch our heads and think, okay, we are still fairly sure we've got LS551, but what is the sort of final proof? And then we did find a panel that had a factory build reference. A fairy released build reference number, which tallies exactly with LS551. Hurrah. So we got there in the end. Yeah, yeah. But even just looking at the numbering on the components is the point of that little story, is how you can really easily just assume, or you run off thinking one thing, but unless you've done the very, very deep critical thinking and the number crunching, you need to have done that to be very sure. Yeah.
Now, one question just before we go and have a look at the airframe. What's the educational benefit of the work you're doing here?
Certainly the today with the STEM interests in schools, looking at what's achievable, you know, looking at, you know, people look at the piles of wreckage and think, what can you do with that? And then, of course, now with the big viewing gallery, because you can stand here and actually watch the team working on the Barracuda, you can hear the machines running, you can hear the benchwork happening, you can watch the progress. That's great interest to a younger generation, which in schools today don't necessarily do metalwork and woodwork as a practical skill. And in an age where even at home, they're probably doing less and less in the garage with their brother or their father or their uncle, these sort of introductions and observations of hand skills, using tools, what you can actually do, what is actually possible, it's a great demonstration for that. As well as then you can see as it's growing the structure of an aircraft. And I know our education team use it as part of the sort of STEM side of the educational visits to get children looking at what's under the skin of an airplane. So you can actually begin to describe how an airplane's built, the tubular structures, how it's fitted together, what's in compression, what's in tension, how it all supports itself. And I think they still do one now where they have an activity in their classroom where they go back and use paper tubes fitted together, rolled paper tubes, which then they can actually experiment with the strength of something which starts out as a single flimsy sheet of paper, but you roll it into a tight tube, fasten it at the ends, and all of a sudden you've got a rigid shape and a rigid form. And they can relate that between what they're seeing with the Barracuda build and experimenting back in the classroom. So I think there's a lot at every age level for the education point of view by watching this program happen.
So you've got seven different wrecks, seven different identities, and one of those you mentioned has three of its own identities. How do you decide which, the finished aircraft, which one gets, which number goes on the side?
I was going to say the same thing. Do we stay with DP-872 or how do we do this?
Well, you want me to answer? Okay. I mean, it's always been the case. DP-872 was the first Barracuda that came to the museum from Northern Ireland. And am I right in saying, David, it was to be rebuilt with the family's permission of the people that died on board to commemorate not just the people on board DPS-72, but all Barracuda crewmen. And so I think DPS-72 has given us the main identity, the main biggest part of our fuselage. Without DPS-72, we wouldn't have the cockpit or the center section to build off of.
Yeah. It was the first piece of Barracuda recovered of any of the wreck pieces. It was the biggest singles chunk of Barracuda that we've been able to recover of any of the wreck sites. And like Will's saying, the families at the time of the crew that died on board said the Fleet Air Arm Museum could have the wreck provided something meaningful was done at some point in time to recognize that crew and all other Barracuda crews. So it'll always be DP-872 and the other Barracudas are feeding into it, but it's actually drawing in now quite a connect with the Barracuda community. Yeah. Some of which were still existing as observers, pilots, telegraphers, air gunners. Sadly, they're becoming fewer each year, but the families are still around, and we're actually putting together quite a collection of Barracuda people. And by people, I mean they're the families of the crews that were on our wrecks or are very closely associated with Barracudas. And I think that's quite an important thing to do, is to not just forget about the Barracuda because the existing crews are no longer with us, but to actually use this project to make the connections for the wider Barracuda community.
Now, it wouldn't be remiss without bringing in Johnny McNee to that discussion about DP-872. And of course, I spoke to him recently and he mentioned you all very fondly. This network's very, very small, isn't it? It's amazing how I'm talking to somebody about aviation archaeology and DP-872 comes up.
Yeah, Johnny's been absolutely brilliant at aiding us re-looking at the crash site of DP-872. There's been a lot of big questions over the years. Where did the tail go? What happened to the rear of the aircraft? It's a very, very gloopy, soupy, porridgey peat bog that it went into. There was every likelihood that maybe something broke off and floated and sank in a slightly different position in the lock area than they had been excavating in 1971. We'd often wondered questions that we couldn't answer, questions that we needed to relook at that lock area. And it's not a huge area. It's probably at about 50, 60 meters in diameter. But that's big enough when you're looking for something underneath a peaty, soupy mass. And Johnny's absolutely great. He's obviously extremely skilled and knowledgeable about how to go about looking for wrecks with all of the permissions. I mean, that's part of his job in his government position in Northern Ireland, in the environmental offices. Plus, he is incredibly enthusiastic and knowledgeable about World War II aircraft and crash sites in Northern Ireland. So having Johnny as somebody that we could connect with and get on board, he did an enormous amount of work to have a re-scan with much more modern equipment than was available in the 1970s to completely scan that lock area and determine that, no, there wasn't anything missed. It was either dragged out at the time and scrapped if it was recoverable, and the rest of the aircraft, sadly, was left under the peat area until the 1970s. So that's how we met Johnny. Great guy, full of enthusiasm, great knowledge. As you can imagine, if you've met Johnny and talked to Johnny, he has contacts all over the place. If you need something to happen in that area of Northern Ireland, if Johnny can't make it happen, it's not really possible to make it happen, you know. Yeah. And he's just brilliant at getting people on board and getting people to understand what's needed and why, and pulling together really enthusiastic, useful teams at quite short notice. So, yeah, big thanks to Johnny for that.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
Welcome from the Royal Aeronautical Society. The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science, and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
The Partnership Edge is the new podcast from XTP Media. It is focused on how trust turns ordinary partnering contracts into successful long-term alliances. Each episode features a senior leader on how behaviours within the partnership can reduce risk, increase innovation, and outperform the shared alliance objectives. Search for The Partnership Edge on your preferred podcast platform to hear more on building trusted partnerships.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
So we're in front now of the frame area. We've got the front fuselage. We can see the engine and we've got parts sitting behind it. Who's going to explain to me what's happened in the last 5 or 6 years since I was last here?
I'm going to say the last time you saw it was probably from the firewall back to that frame there. And the next stage I'm going to hand over to Will because he has such detailed knowledge of what he's been doing. Well, I mean, Will's effectively the engineering lead on the project. I mean, yes, I run the department, of course, and oversee many, many areas of this project and others, but Will is the focus on what is actually happening here on the shop floor in the jig day by day.
So Will, take us through what's happened and what you're working on and how it's all evolved.
So the last time you were here, we definitely had a firewall and we definitely had frame 11, which is the main spar carry through from the wings through the cockpit. And I think there may have been one or two tubes. So since then, we have completed the tubular structure of the cockpit. We've got the bomb aimers horseshoe shear box structure in, which incidentally was never used as a bomb aimer's position in the Barracuda. It was deleted.
I was going to say, I can't remember Dad ever talking or mentioning that to me.
Yeah, no, it was sheeted over on production Barracudas and never used for that purpose. And we're doing a dry build of the observer's cockpit section. The rear spar was badly damaged, as was the front spar. And the sidewalls and the bottom longerons of the observer's cockpit were badly damaged. So we're having to do a dry build, because...
What does that mean, Will?
So a dry build is, we got lots to fix on the observer's cockpit. So we, unfortunately, and I'd love to have them, we don't have the original jigs. So we can't actually... just make new parts and fit them in. They won't fit. So we're doing a dry build of what's left of DP872's structure that we know is straight, dimensionally accurate. And that allows us to make new parts, put them in, and drill them off when we've built our own jig. And it just helps us to sort of make sure that everything is in line, straight. You know, there's quite a lot of holes. I'll show you over here, Peter. I know it's not any use on a on this, but for your eyes, so say like these bolts here, where it's in the crash, they bolt holes can become elongated.
Okay.
And bolts can become slightly stressed, so that leads to sloppiness. So when we're looking at the rear hinge on the rear spar for the wings, the hinge pins don't line up.
Yeah.
So we have to we have to do a dry build and work out what's going on, what's dimensionally accurate and what's not, and then we can rectify all those little problems. And then people think, well, you've done that. Well, we've got to take it all apart again.
Yeah.
Because it has to be then go through the process of corrosion treatments, the plating processes, be it zinc, nickel plating or anodizing. And then obviously priming and top coats before it can go back together again and be all riveted up.
Right. So I think I understand now what a dry build is. It's complicated. There's a lot of rework. You build, take down, reassemble, recoat.
Yeah.
But the thing that jumps out to me, Will, from the last time I was here, and I was mentioning it to Dave Homewood earlier, is whenever I've seen photos, videos of Barracuda, they always seem so small and flimsy. This is quite a big aircraft, isn't it?
It is a very big aircraft. Don't forget that when she's on a undercarriage, the undercarriage is made up of a, obviously a leg, and then a triangular section called a torsion box,
yeah,
which you can see behind you over there. When you've got a wheel with the undercarriage and the torsion box on the aircraft, it's almost face height.
Mm.
And then you've got the rest of the aircraft above that. She's a big animal and a long animal as well.
Oh. I'm very excited to see the wings on this, because obviously it's a unique feature of how the Barracuda looks and comes together. But we've got the observer section in front of us, obviously the pilot section, and I'm going to ask the inevitable tag element that will come next. How will that come together, and where will that come together from?
So we're just jigging up, as I say, that the observer's cockpit with the rear spar. Once we got that all drilled off and riveted up, the observer's cockpit won't be finished. We'll still have to put floor plates in. The floor structure will be in, but we still have to put floor plates in, you know, control surface, you know, control mechanisms and control runs and all that. But then that will allow us to use the observer's cockpit and the rear spar as a jig in its own right.
Yeah.
We can build our jig going backwards off of DP872, and that'll allow us to rebuild the rear fuselage.
So what's on the to-do list today? What are you working on this week?
So I'm just finishing off the observer's floor section. So we've got two floor runners, which are the main beams in the observer's floor to do. That's quite a complex little animal.
So it seems quite simple, but actually pulling it together and getting the dimensions and the measurements right.
When you've got the crash components, you think, oh, that's just a U-channel. And it's not until you look at the drawings, which thankfully we've got for that area. It's not a simple U-section, and it's got a belly to it, and the angles are slightly angled, and trying to make it's making the formers to form all those components around. It takes longer to make those than it does actually to make the piece.
Okay, I can't get my head around that. But
reading 1940s drawings is an art in its own right.
Yeah. Now I see around the airframe bits with aircraft registration numbers on and plates and little bags hanging and things like that. The purpose of that is,
so if you see a little bag hanging off a, especially the front end, that's parts that are associated to that area, that when we come back to that area, because the cockpit's not finished yet, we've still got a lot of work to do to that. That's little components that have been restored and are ready to go back on in that area. It's just so we don't lose where they come from, even though they're documented and it's all photographed. It's just nice to have them there, ready to go back on.
So, Will, we just moved further forward and we're back in front of the pilot's area. Tell us about this tubular work.
So, on a Barracuda, the cockpit area was a tubular truss section, and then it goes after that it goes into stress skin monocoque, and then the last frame in the rear fuselage, which is frame 26, it turns back into tubular work again. So if you
is that unique to the Barracuda?
No, I think the if you look at Ferry 4 Mile was the same. Albacore, not so much. It had a tubular rear section, which is called the rear wedge. But yes, it's sort of fairies of that time until you went to sort of like a Firefly. The Firefly had a tubular rear wedge, but it had more of a monocoque construction for the fuselage. So, I mean, it looks a bit agricultural when you're looking at it.
I think some of the people who flew in it described it in those terms as well.
I can imagine a Barracuda being quite rattly and agricultural when you're sat in the cockpit, but still beautiful. Yeah,
we love it.
So in terms of the tubular structure in the cockpit, it's made up of DP872's tubular structure. We've got quite a few parts from the Solent wreck, which has sort of saved our bacon in some areas. And we had a wreck, a Blackburn-built Barracuda, front half of a cockpit that came out of a scrapyard. That's that the firewall comes from, and some tube ends and bits and pieces. So it's an amalgamation of three aircraft, effectively.
There's many engineering challenges, of course, with all of this, but what is the next, what's the thing that's burning on your mind that you're coming up to that you feel is going to be a really, really big challenge?
Oh, it's going to be the rear fuselage. Yeah. We've got the fuselage, we've got the front cockpit structure. That's all done. It's basically just infilling putting the aprons on, which is the cockpit sides, and the torsion box wells, which is what the undercarriage sits into. That's all quite easy stuff. I mean, we've still got a cockpit floor to do. You can see some of it, half of it already in. It's not too bad. It's the rear fuselage. It's getting it jigged up, making sure that it's straight. We got to have new bottom longerons extruded, which we're looking into at the minute. That's quite a big animal to do. The top longerons are quite easy to produce. They're only an angle, which, you know, we can get pressed up. Lower longerons, and making sure that the cockpit is jigged, the rear fuselage is jigged to accept the last fuselage frame, which we got most of it. So
now I'm fascinated by the wings, obviously very big, very wide. What's the plan for the wings?
So luckily we have an almost complete wing from DR306, which incidentally is another Blackburn built, Bolton Paul built Barracuda, same as DP872. I think they're a year apart. We've got almost a complete set of drawings. We haven't really studied that area too much because we've just been concentrating on the fuselage. But we know we've got an almost complete set of drawings for that, and we've got a wing that we can study. So that helps immensely. I think the biggest problems that we're going to encounter with the wings is the top and bottom cappings for the spars. They're like a T section, aluminium, very long extruded sections. And there's quite a few metal doubling plates along the way, and it's all quite long stuff that's going to be challenging to make. But in terms of ribs, I mean, ribs are quite easy to make, you know.
So, Dave, what are we unraveling here.
Well, for a number of reasons, we've got some, again, interested parties that might be interested in sponsoring or funding parts of the build coming over the next few days, plus a lecture for the Society of Friends next week. So, and also just for our own update and recap of where we are. So all of those reasons combined, we thought we would lay out all of the pieces which have been completed, where people might see the fuselage and say, it's great, it looks good, but is there any other progress? Well, while we're waiting to progress the fuselage tube, we certainly haven't been idle. So stand back and watch this while I unveil with Will everything that we've worked on and completed to date. So everything you see on the floor has been absolutely done back to meticulous standard. Here we go.
So I'm looking at an unveiling here. Wow. It looks like the biggest jigsaw puzzle. Wow, we'll have a photo in the show notes that Dave Homewood's going to hopefully take for me. And I'm walking from the rear towards the front of the aircraft and all the parts and the main elements that have already been restored. Wow. It's quite an amazing picture of an aircraft that no single airframe exists. Dave, I'm gonna lean across this jig here. That's quite an impressive layout. I mean, I wouldn't want you to describe everything, but what have we got in general here?
Oh, I'm actually going to hand back across to Will, who can give a much better detail. I mean, we've got components finished from every stage of the build, and Will can show you some good bits in detail, but some of it is completely logical because it's the parts and components that we need next on the actual fuselage build itself. Some are parts where it's made sense to have them plated or treated in whatever kind of metal finishing as a batch. So there's sort of batch size common sense just for usefulness there, as well as bits which when you're taking one component section apart, you think, okay, might as well do the associated bit as well, so that when that's complete, we've got it all done in advance of when we need it on the build. So there's different stages, but Will can talk you through. It's a sea of parts, and if you look down through it, it's a complete sea of parts. Will can talk you through a lot of the detail. Pump over there, the foot control brace there.
I mean, it just goes to show. I mean, this isn't anywhere near the number of parts that the final aircraft would have, but there's a fair spread.
There is a fair spread, yeah. And this is just fuselage.
Oh, okay.
This is, you know, fuselage and some elevator components down the bottom end.
What are those very large pieces?
So these ones, so these big tubes?
Yeah.
So this is undercarriage.
Wow.
Undercarriage legs.
Thank you, aren't they?
They are. They seem to survive really well on all the crashes. yeah, so we got one that's from DP872. So she's been restored and is waiting to go back together. You can see, if I just walk over here a minute, you can see we've got an axle. We've got most of the internals of that oleo. We've got original seals that are still viable. Wow. So we've got behind you as well, if you look over there, you'll see an undercarriage unit,
yep,
that we've previously built, and that's all original, and it still holds its oil and it still holds air.
Wow. Yeah, I remember that was the one of the things I walked away with on the last day, is it when you opened it up, it still was sealed and had the original oil.
And we've reused the original oil. It's still,
wow,
of a quality that we can put back in again, and we have done. We've got a spare leg casing there that we've had. Now that came from the Solent wreck.
Okay.
The leg casing we've got is slightly corroded that we've previously restored, so we might swap it out in the future. So we just had that.
Because you haven't got enough to do.
So, well, you know. it we like to do it, you know.
Tell me, one thing that's obviously caught my eye is the Perspex there.
Yes. Oh, it's great, isn't it? That Perspex is from the Solent.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's...
It's amazing.
That is Observer's sliding hood. Perspex, and you can just see one little part is broken on it, but we can fix that and put it back together. But that is a complete set of Observer sliding hood Perspex.
It's unbelievable. It's sat on that seabed
for, I know,
70 80 years,
and we've only just given it a very quick clean. It needs to be cleaned a bit more because you can still see slight limpets where the limpets have been on it and walking around, and you can see the limpets where the shells have been grazing on it. But for all intents and purposes, it's like it's made yesterday. It's fantastic.
Then just before we go, Will, do you have a favourite part?
Ooh, that's a tricky one.
Well, flip it on its head. Have you got a part that's tested you beyond your means?
Yes. That's a difficult one to answer because I think quite a lot of parts do that on a Barracuda. You know, don't forget, we're working with Bolton Pool, Blackburn, Westlands, and Fairies made parts, and they don't go together.
Mm.
You know, we have to take that into consideration. I think my favourite part. I'm going to send you my favourite part, and that is the tag seat, which we've done a bit of work on, and this seat has come out of the Solent.
What's that made of, Will?
So it's aeroplastic construction. It's paper, resin, compressed seat parts. And if I just point you over there, look, you see the bits on there. That's what they look like when they come out of the Solent. So they're still to be worked on.
Yes.
And then when we finish with them, they look like
that's
that.
That's what they look like.
It's just a... That's why, because we were missing the pilot, the tag seat. We didn't have one in any of the other crashes, apart from the Solent wreck.
You mentioned about all the thousands of parts that you've managed to collect together, but what sort of percentage or guesstimate of percentage are the parts that you still need that you haven't found?
Who am I coming to for that?
I'm looking at Will on that one. I don't know. We talk about this daily, and me and Will often bat ideas about how much each section of Barracuda is totally original or has a high percentage of originality, and how much we're going to have to make, because throughout all of the wrecks, certain bits just do not exist amongst any of the wreckage. So, I mean, we get to look at the centre section in a minute. Will can point that out in detail. But at the moment, the forward section, sort of cockpit and part of the centre section, I would think we're probably better than 80% completely original Barracuda parts in that. That's going to reduce a little immediately after the observer section, because it just doesn't exist on any of the other aircraft in any sensible shape that we can use. And then it will increase again towards the tail, because we've actually got quite a lot of tail that's original as well. So it's a bit of a wavy line. The percentage increases and decreases depending on what section we're working on. But overall, we're probably going to have better than 70% original Barracuda overall at the end of the day.
That's fantastic.
So, Dave, an amazing restoration project. I don't know quite whether we're halfway, quarter away, 10%, 1%, or 98% complete. Every time I come, we seem to move the numbers forwards and backwards. But what happens next?
What happens next? Good question. Vision of that moving backwards and forwards is one we get daily here, but it is, I can assure you, it is moving forwards. If you see, look at that sea of parts on the floor, I think that should underline the fact that there's an awful lot happening, even if it doesn't always look like it on the jig. We're looking for the next stages of funding. We're looking into planning now. We're looking at companies that can manufacture us the long runs that we need as extrusions, because that's key to having remade. Yeah, the long runs are something which we don't have in one piece long enough to support that fuselage rear frame, so that's key next. That's our focus.
Seeing as we're here, what are you looking for? What sort of businesses, maybe someone who's listening may be able to put you on to somebody? What do you need? What's the ask?
It's extrusions, metal extrusions, long metal forming. So if we need angle shapes forming out of aluminium, we need people that have got a machine or forming machine that can do it at sort of 18, 20 feet in length. That's the bigger problem. We can get people to do it. People don't have that length to do them in one running section, which is what we need. So we've got no joints. Ribs and stringers, again, whether they're drawn or extruded or folded, people that have got the capability to follow the fairy drawings accurately but produce them in usefully long lengths. The actual fuselage frames, quite a few of those, the actual sort of fuselage egg-shaped former frames to run down through the fuselage, companies that can make the formers and then properly form those frames to match the few that we've got, which we can salvage, but we're going to have a lot of frames made just to get that fuselage skeleton shape in place. So that's what we're running for at the moment. Companies out there that have got those skills to aircraft standard, you know, and it's not going to fly. So, you know, we're not looking for something for flight quality, but we're looking for something for aircraft quality. And the difference there will be the cost. Right. We can accept slight deviations on metal spec because it's not actually going to be airworthy. But we still need the crafted standard to be there. Otherwise, nothing really fits for the rest of the fuselage. So that's our big move forward next, is that rear fuselage section. In the meantime, there's plenty of other stuff happening for all of the components, which will then fit to that fuselage when it's done.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for talking to us again, and good luck with the next stage.
Thank you, Peter. Pleasure as always. Come back anytime you like. And yeah, I hope the next time you'll see equally a useful progress again. Thank you.
And Will, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Oh, not a problem. It's a pleasure having you here. Nice to see you again.
We're reaching out to manufacturers, engineering businesses, piping, welding, and aviation manufacturers. Please do see if you can help Will and Dave with some of the parts they need to get access to. This is purely funded by charitable sources and has no mainstream funding, and you could help preserve one of Britain's rarest naval aircraft for future generations. We'd like to thank White Hearts for our music, and I'd like to thank Dave Homewood for his patience with me during this visit, and also the persistence to make sure that Extended gets some really great feature topics. Don't forget our book, Constant Endeavour, RAF Coastal Command. It's available in audiobook and accompanying ebook form. You can find the audiobook on all major audiobook platforms and the ebook through Amazon. Please do buy a copy, as every penny goes to Help for Heroes. You can find me, Nascot Hornet, on social media, and of course through all the multiple XTB media platforms. And you can find Tim, Ellie and Gareth on both their personal and of course through the Extended social feeds. That's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. This is Aerospace Radio Station, Extended. Legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended!
It's is XTP Media.